Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, January 27th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho House Committee passes local preemption bill that would prevent local jurisdictions from requiring masks to save people from deadly viruses. Idaho House passes Representative Heather Scott's bill, or resolution rather, asking U.S. Supreme Court to define marriage as between one man and one woman for all states, but Scott repeatedly says it's a state rights issue. And Michael Strickland, the Latah County Human Rights Task Force's Rosa Parks Award breakfast keynote speaker, says human rights bills in the 1960s, such as the Voting Rights Act, did not usher in an era that was needed to eradicate systemic racism in this country. Well, details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Despite arguments from health experts and advocates from cities and other local governments, the Idaho House State Affairs Committee voted along party lines Monday to advance a bill from Republican Representative Robert Biswanger of Horseshoe Bend that would ban local municipalities, school districts, and health districts from employing mask mandates in order to save lives from deadly infectious diseases. Bill sponsor Biswanger made the claim that local governments had abused certain citizens during the pandemic while trying to save lives from the deadly COVID-19 virus, which killed more than 4,000 Idahoans.
I'll be right up front with you today. House Bill 32 is probably the best bill you're going to hear all year.
We have good bills in here every day, Representative. So if you want this to pass, you might want to just think about what you're saying there.
Well, simply put, House Bill 32 prohibits any government official from requiring people to wear a mask for the purpose of preventing virus transmission, as happened a few years ago. And first, you can all know and be very excited about the fact this bill does not cost the taxpayers a single penny. Second, it expands the amount of freedom all the Idahoans get. They will no longer have to worry about potential or imposed jail times, fines from the government for simply not wearing a face mask. Now, medical professionals who may need to wear them, like a surgeon or a dentist who, you know, they got spit and saliva, you know, going this and that, they may be required to wear them. Or if you're a construction worker, a welder, you've got concrete dust in the air, you might need to wear one to prevent, you know, concrete from getting in your lungs. It's very dangerous. Those people are exempted from House Bill 32. And third, I want everyone to know, here, anywhere, that if you would still like to wear a mask, you are certainly welcome to do so. You still can. So if you're in the grocery store and someone gets within, say, 6 feet of you and you want to whip out your mask, put it on, you can feel safe having your mask on. I mean, there was a guy in Boise years ago during all this mess that he was riding a motorcycle down, no helmet on, but he still had his cloth mask on. I mean, it's not really the decision I would have made. I don't know if that's really something I agree with, but, you know, he would still be allowed to wear his mask, you know, going forward. So we don't want to restrict their rights either. So you're protecting the rights of people to wear the mask and not to wear the mask in this bill. So nowhere in this bill in any way does it prohibit them from wearing it. Now, to be honest with you, for those government officials who will be restricted by this bill, they still have some options, right? They just can't threaten jail time. They can't, you know, fine you, put your, you know, business under. They can advise us. They can recommend us. They can suggest to us. They can have a conversation with us. Really, I'm just kind of asking they treat us like adults, that we can decide what we want to do with the information's out there. These are all of the information's available through different websites, you know, recommendations, studies, and so on. And the sad fact is, you know, I'm trying to be a little lighthearted here, but the government, you know, our people in our government did abuse our citizens back then. And this bill is an attempt to kind of remedy that and protect our citizens going forward.
That was Mask Local Preemption Bill sponsor, Republican Representative Robert Biswanger of Horseshoe Bend. Democratic Representative Ted Aquiles of Boise had a question for Biswanger.
Are you an epidemiologist, or you consult with any epidemiologists or public health officials in writing this bill?
Representative Biswanger.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Aquiles, no, I'm not. And I am not. So.
Follow up, Mr.
Certainly.
Chairman? Yeah, and you did not consult with any public health officials in writing this?
Representative Biswanger.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Aquiles, No, I didn't. This is more of a moral issue here. And I mean, I think there's plenty of information now. I mean, I went to the FDA's website, read different studies. The Brown Institute's got hundreds of websites listed there debating and discussing the efficacy of masks. It's kind of been a big public topic the past few years. There's different opinions on both sides. But for the most part, you can read it right on the FDA's website. They'll tell you that these cloth masks we're talking about, the holes, the gaps, even though it's hard to see with the human eye, the viruses will pass right through them. And so I don't know. It's really a great, you know. Go ahead.
Understand. Yep. Follow up? Chairman, to follow up? Yes, please. So, Representative Bice, I mean, can you describe how an N95 mask, you know, specifically the Browning motion and the electrostatic attraction that helps an N95 mask be more efficient?
Representative Biswinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Achilles. I mean, I'm not necessarily a mask, you know, expert on this kind of stuff, you know. So, I mean, you know, you can look together. They're supposed to be more secure. They keep more. Those masks are more secure than the ones, than the typical cloth or surgical masks, which is what most of the mask mandates were required to do. Those were involved there.
Yeah, agreed.
Follow up?
One more. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Biswinger, you know, I guess back to a philosophical level on this. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you think it's okay for the government to mandate that cars drive 20 miles an hour in a school zone, but we don't want government mandating masks? And, you know, I think both are intended to promote public safety and protect vulnerable populations. So I'm trying to understand, you know, how do we justify those two perspectives on the role of government?
Representative Biswinger.
Chairman Gray and Representative Achilles. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's obviously lots of things we're involved in here. I think the government needs to have, you know, the least restrictive environment possible here. You know, masks can become dirty. They become whatever. I mean, throw them out. They're really, you know, we learned in the COVID, you know, stuff, even when it first came out, people didn't recommend masks. You remember Dr. Fauci said, no, we don't want you to wear a mask. It's not really necessary. Later that changed. And then I think later on, Fauci was quoted saying, we don't really even know where that suggestion came from. Like it just sort of came. We all kind of went with it. You know, again, these are things you're supposed to be for operating rooms to help doctors prevent spit and saliva from contacting a patient during an operation. They were never meant just to be worn out in the public at all times. You know, there's something specific, you know, for certain situations, but not also not for, you know, and even dealing with virus transmission.
Any further questions for Representative Biswinger? Okay, Representative, I've got a question for you. Following up on that line of questioning by Representative Achilles, do you know of any businesses? I think the example you used was seatbelts. Do you know of any businesses where the government has said if your employees are not wearing seatbelts, they'll fine you $80,000?
Chairman Green, no, did not.
Before voting, the State Affairs Committee took public comments. Association of Idaho Cities Executive Director Kelly Packer outlined her group's strong opposition to House Bill 32 from Representative Biswinger.
You are blocking elected officials' authority to make decisions, informed decisions down the road on things we may not have any idea about. That's exactly where you found elected officials in 2020 and 2021. All of us, including here in this building, were dealing with an unknown. And as was already mentioned, there was information on both sides, pro masks, con masks, right? In Idaho alone, most cities did not implement a mask mandate, even though there were public health districts recommending that they do so. Even here in the Treasure Valley, you had cities that did not implement mask mandates. But the local electeds did what they thought was right for their community. Higher density areas felt like that there was more need for protection for the residents in their area, the people they had jurisdiction over. They were trying their best to make informed decisions to keep their residents safe, to keep their communities healthy. And that's what we would ask moving forward, is that you allow them to make those decisions as they come forward. I happen to be raised in a dental family, and I worked for my father for a number of years, and I was both vaccinated for Hep C as well as wore a mask to prevent that contagion from impacting my life negatively moving forward. The science played that out. With COVID, we didn't know what the science would confirm and what it wouldn't. And so we had to make decisions in the moment. Just like in this building in 2021, well, in 2020, you went home early because we didn't know. And in 2021, testimony was restricted to virtual. People were closed off from being here. We were trying to deal with it as we could on the fly, and we would ask for that same authority in the future because we don't know what we may face down the road. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you, Ms. Packer. Are there questions for Ms. Packer? First of all, Representative Scott, followed by Representative Barbieri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Packer, I'm curious, do you believe that a city council member is responsible for the citizens' health?
Ms. Packer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott. Actually, elected officials at all levels are tasked with the health and safety and well-being of those people that they're elected to represent.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Packer, so there's a problem with diabetes in this country. Do you think a city council member should restrict pop and sodas in a community because too high of a percentage of their community is diabetic?
Ms. Packer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott. I think that you're not comparing apples to apples, and the reason I say that is no city elected knows exactly who has diabetes, who doesn't. They also, as has been mentioned, shouldn't take away the free will of people to decide. However, we were dealing with a pandemic. We were dealing with a situation where we did not know what was going to keep people safe and what wasn't. And we were under strict guidance to still allow for open meeting laws. So people were still allowed to come into our buildings, regardless of whether they were sick or they weren't. And so in order to protect those that were coming to participate in our required open meetings, they did the best they could with what information they had. And as I mentioned before, only a handful actually implemented mask mandates.
One last follow-up, please.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Packer. So you mentioned that we were dealing with a pandemic, but as I recall, according to what the numbers look like in our state and according to our code and administrative rule, we weren't anything near a pandemic. So when these city councils or mayors make decisions on people's health, do you think there could be some influence from outside of our state or our cities that you're maybe getting talking points, they could be getting talking points or that do not apply to Idaho and making decisions from a higher level that really don't apply to our state?
Ms. Peck.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, as I recall, there was an emergency mandate from the state. There was also public health districts here in the state recommending that these certain things be implemented. Elected officials, based on those two components, had to act. And therefore, they did. They made decisions, and you did have a handful that decided to implement the mask mandate, but you had just as many or more, in fact, the majority, that did not. And so what we're saying is that let elected officials at every level, your level and our level, make those decisions as they need to, as they arise in their community.
That was Association of Idaho Cities Executive Director Kelly Packer answering a question from Republican Representative Heather Scott of Blanchard during Monday's hearing before the Idaho House State Affairs Committee on Republican Representative Robert Beiswenger's bill to ban mask mandates in local governments in Idaho. Bill's supporters included the Idaho Freedom Foundation, the Health Freedom Defense Fund, and several people who proudly said they had been arrested or attended the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol that caused the eventual death of five people and almost completed then-President Trump's goal of overthrowing U.S. democracy. The bill now heads to the full House.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
You listen to the radio. You've got it right.
Listen, anytime you listen, everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio.
Listen to the radio.
You got it right.
Community radio.
Listen to you give a little listen to the radio.
Radio Free Moscow. Fight Back Radio. It's 90.3 on your radio dial. Fight Back.
Thanks for tuning in and thanks for your support. So keep on listening and listening and listening.
Fight Back.
We're still here.
Radio. Fight Back. Fight Back. Fight Back.
During Monday's budget hearing in the Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee meeting, University of Idaho President C. Scott Green faced questions on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, which the State Board of Education recently banned on campuses statewide. Some of the questions came from Republican Representative Josh Tanner of Eagle.
And I've been going through your guys' last financial report that you guys sent out for the end of year of June 30th of 2024. Going through that, I see that there's a large list of federal expenditures that were awarded to your university. And I can't seem to figure out how they're not showing up on our financials within the state. So it looks like it's more of like an off book. I know there's some language and some laws that allow you guys to do that, but within that, I'm seeing a pass-through, and I don't have, really, there's not a lot of description on this, but we're passing $20 to $30 million outside to sub-recipients. So just curious if maybe you could provide me a list of what those sub-recipients, who we're actually sending that money to, as well as if you think that we should actually have oversight from the legislature over these federal grants that I would assume you're requesting.
President Green.
Thank you, Chair. So we are a large research institution. Our total budget is around $400 million. Most of that is either research or monies that come to us through our foundation. We do have a lot of subs that participate in that. We partner with a lot of universities around the country on those. And if we are the lead on those research contracts, then we make distributions to those other universities as well. I'm sure we can get you a list of those. I don't know how that oversight would necessarily work, but, you know, we do have an Office of Compliance, which basically makes sure that everything that we distribute, you know, is appropriate. So, but yeah, we'll do our best to give you the information you're asking for.
Follow up.
Madam Chair. No, I appreciate that report. And it did look like only about $50 million of them were actually research grants. So there was a significant amount that was still passed through. But on to within further in that report was the DEI aspect. I know you spoke on it briefly, but it looks like the total expense that you had reported within there was over $1.2 million. I know a portion of it you talked about that you're retaining it. One of the FTPs will be retained in one aspect. But how much can we actually revert back to the general fund based on the decision from the state board not to do this, or are you guys going to just redivert the money to something else?
Yeah. So actually there's zero money in the general fund that's been going to this. And I think most of you are aware we're here that no general education funding has been used to support these positions because there was basically a law passed a couple of years ago that basically said we shouldn't do that. So, and I think we even adjusted before that came into effect. So the need for support services hasn't changed. The students impacted by the changes are now going to be supported through the same office as everybody else. So we have replaced the eliminated positions with new roles designed to serve all students. Over the past eight semesters, our enrollment has steadily increased. It's up nearly 14% since 2020, underscoring the need to continue to employ staff who support all students with the services they need, such as advising, tutoring, information sessions on financial aid, or other non-academic services. Many of our initiatives are now focused on supporting first-gen students, as I mentioned earlier. So I can give you a couple examples. For instance, Mario Pyle, the former director of the Black Student Center, now serves as Associate Director of Student Involvement. He'll be responsible for developing and mentoring and leadership programs for all students. His extensive background in leadership roles, including his service in the military, and at the Idaho Youth Ranch, makes him an exceptional leader for students engaged in clubs, community services, and athletics. And retaining talent like Mario with such specialized expertise ensures we continue to provide high-quality support to our students and prevents us from losing valuable team members to institutions in other states. I mentioned the other positions that have been eliminated and have not been filled, and they could possibly generate some savings for us. But again, we never seem to have enough to fully support our students as well as we would like. So hopefully that answers your question.
And that was University of Idaho President C. Scott Green answering questions from Representative Josh Tanner of Eagle during Monday's Joint Finance Appropriations hearing on the University of Idaho's budget. President Green mentioned Mario Pyle, who until December was University of Idaho Black African American Cultural Center Executive Director. Green said the university has reassigned Pyle to a different position. Last year, Mario Pyle was the keynote speaker at the Latah County Human Rights Task Force's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast. The keynote speaker at this year's Latah County Human Rights Task Force 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast, which was held Saturday, was Boise State University Communications Professor Michael Strickland, who is founder of the nonprofit Human Rights Collective. Strickland is also on the State Library Board and is promoter of children's books that address human rights. He currently lives in Pocatello. Strickland said, "It's been more than 50 years after Congress passed three major pieces of civil rights legislation, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act, but the passages of those bills did not usher in the profound changes needed to eradicate systemic racism in this country."
More than half century later, some assert that little has fundamentally changed or improved. And after recent events, including the election, I can see why many think that way, including me, prior to the election. Just 1 year ago, I was at a Rotary Club meeting in Pocatello, feeling pretty good. I was invited to sit at the table with Mayor Blatt and the mayor of Chugbeck, Idaho, who were addressing our Rotary with their State of the Cities, respectively, address. Very polite, welcoming crowd, my club. I'm now Sergeant at Arms in the Rotary, and I'm proud to be Vice President and President. So there's some people in town there in Pocatello really doing the right thing for inclusion. I left for an even better reason, or equally as good, because I was meeting a donor. The Human Rights Collective was doing an online fundraiser. One of the hotel sales managers was donating a bunch of passes and some books for us to sell. So I was right across from Pocatello High School. That's where the venue was. Walked out, made a right. I was just going to walk to my car so I could go have my second very validating, happy meeting. And I heard the word nigger screamed very loudly in an even more harsh tone than I just did it. When you're recalling pain, it's hard to reenact it. And then I heard it again, the exact word. And then I heard big black monkey. I was in an alleyway, so I had walked to my right. I was in an alleyway, walking, had made another right in the alleyway. So I was walking away from Pocatello High School to the parking lot that's there. Some of you know where those train tracks are in the parking lot. And I was frozen. What could I do? Think about the situation. It happens to a lot of us who are marginalized and in hostile situations. Do I suddenly become Captain America, the Fantastic Four, and go fight or something? And in this case, I was literally trapped, and there was all kinds of metaphors coming out and symbolism, because I was faced with a choice. I froze up for a minute, because that's what hostility does to a human being. I turned around, and all I could see were a group of basically what appeared to be high school kids walking in front of the high school. I don't know who yelled it. I don't know who they were yelling at. Was it me or someone else? My thoughts started to race. Was there a kid being abused right there? I had gone from one meeting to another in our normal rush. I had to meet someone in order to advance the very cause that that comment was speaking against. And of course, I'm by myself, feeling alone, afraid, confused, not having information. I don't have a police cruiser, vehicles, radios, all kinds of things like that, but call for backup. I didn't even know if it was a Pocatello High School student who said the word. So I was faced with a literal and also symbolic and metaphorical choice. Do I walk forwards or do I walk backwards? Walking backwards would have meant trying to assess the situation, see what's going on, possibly make a phone call, call who, the cops, call and say what, someone's yelling things. And then walking forward meant I had an appointment. You know how it is when you're running a nonprofit. You got to be where you say you're going to be and do what you're going to do. And ironically, it was the exact cause that that Lyle's hostile racism was working against. It was a kind of a win-win, lose-lose, whatever. It was pick one, six of one, half dozen of the other. So literally, and now thinking back symbolically and metaphorically, because I also had to think about myself, what exactly am I walking into? I walked forward. I walked away from the negativity, the hostility, racism. But I internalized. And I can still hear his voice saying those words. I did pause long enough to see if it appeared that anyone was being accosted, and I couldn't see anything like that. I just saw kids walking. I thought to myself, Pocatello High School has an administrator. They have a school resource officer. There's other people around. All I could do is pray that no one was being hurt. And if I want to advance the cause, I have a choice. Move forward. It was a tough one, but it symbolizes and symbolized the complexity and everything we're going through. All I can do now is keep moving forward. Fortunately, I'm an optimist. And once again, on King's Dream, I know it's there. Today, more than ever. As painful as that was, and here's another part of the picture, it was words. As Ta-Nehisi Coates points out, some people often assume that all racism is simply equated with individual acts of hostility, but structural racism is still deep. And as I walked forward to try to build an organization, something like what you have here, I was moving toward addressing structural racism. King believed that democracy is not a state. It is an act, and each generation must do its part to help build what he called the beloved community, a nation and a world society at peace with itself. We ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of our nation. Are you ready to rise? As Cornel West said, never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. Amen. This is about hope, today more than ever. Switching fonts, getting older. Switching fonts means switching glasses. Many of you know that. This book, as we speak about hope, is Open a World Possible. Real stories about the joy and power of reading. It is by Lois Bridges, and one of the participants in the book is my mom, Dorothy Strickland. This is called The Gift of Reading, Pass It On. Dorothy, I'm so glad to see you. I saved a book especially for you. It was the voice of Mrs. Lewis, the librarian at the neighborhood branch library, that I visited regularly in Union, New Jersey, where I grew up. She reached down under her desk and pulled out that special book and handed it to me with a smile that seemed to say that she had been waiting all week just for me. The library in our part of town was located in a storefront nestled among several small businesses, including a delicatessen, dry cleaners, and drugstore. At age 11, I was old enough to walk to the library all by myself. So Mrs. Lewis had become one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. Context, we're in Union, New Jersey, and this would have been 1944, when there were still whites-only signs on certain places and whites-only water fountains. De jure segregation was still in place. She was perfectly round, round body, round face, and hair that was pulled back neatly into a perfectly round bun. She was always welcoming and pleasant. To think that she would select a book just for me made me feel very special. Whatever she selected would be read along with the books I selected on my own. Born into an African-American working-class family with parents who migrated from the South with limited educational opportunities, I don't recall either ever seeing them reading a book. Although my dad often quoted portions of the newspaper. Fortunately, my parents indulged my love of reading and seemed to know how important it was to me. Little did any of us know that I would one day become president of the International Reading Association and the State of New Jersey Professor of Reading at Rutgers University. My mom went on from there to being the Samuel DeRitt Proctor Chair at Rutgers, and prior to Rutgers, she was the Arthur I. Gates Chair at Columbia University. International Reading Associations, IRA, International Reading Association, is now the International Reading Association. She also ended up in the Reading Hall of Fame. Fascinating story if you get a chance to pick this up from Open, A World of Possible. Reading from a book about hope, Mrs. Lueck inspired one black girl in 1944. Here in Moscow in 2025, who can you inspire? Who can you give hope to today? Is King's dream still alive? I believe it is, and there's an example. Think about the resources we have at our fingertips now. Think about what Mrs. Lueck did. Can you be a Mrs. Lueck to someone? Have you been? And who can you do that for today? As Father Greg Boyle, who has worked with to rehabilitate thousands of gang members in Los Angeles, says, no hopeful kid has ever joined a gang. One of my favorite and most fascinating quotes. Worked with thousands of gangbangers in LA. No kid who is filled with hope has ever joined a gang. Is King's dream still alive? Looks that way to me. We suffer from disparities rooted in centuries of systemic exclusion, from slavery to redlining to discriminatory lending practices. Economic inequality is more rampant than perhaps ever. How many people feel that way today? The promise of democracy. What did it mean to King? What does it mean to us? During King's lifetime, he was regularly spied on by the FBI, constantly threatened, continuously arrested, and ultimately murdered for the cause of freedom and justice for all. Quote, in any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. One, collection of the facts to determine whether injustices are alive. Two, negotiation. Three, self-purification. And four, what you're doing here now, and what we heard about earlier, direct action.
That was Boise State University Communications Professor Michael Strickland, who was the keynote speaker at the 32nd Annual Latah County Human Rights Task Force Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast, which was held at the 1912 Center in Moscow Saturday. Strickland is the founder of the nonprofit Human Rights Collective, an Idaho State Library Board member and promoter of children's books that address human rights issues. The website of Strickland's nonprofit Human Rights Collective and its Dorothy Strickland Scholarship is human-rights-today.org. That's human-rights-today.org. The Idaho House voted 46-24 Monday to approve a resolution from Republican Representative Heather Scott of Blanchard that would ask the U.S. Supreme Court to, quote, restore the natural definition of marriage, a union of one man and one woman, unquote. The resolution, also called a memorial, has no impact on law, but if it passes in the Senate as well, is supposed to represent the position of the Idaho legislature. While Scott is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to change the definition of marriage in all 50 states, she repeatedly said the bill was about states' rights and allowing states to define marriage within their borders. Scott said this is to restore federalism, calling for the issue of marriage laws to the states, not to the federal government. Democratic Representative Elena Rubel of Boise, the House Minority Leader, said on the House floor, it actually calls for the U.S. Supreme Court to declare that from coast to coast, essentially, the union is between a man and a woman. So this is not about deferring it to states' rights. It's about coming up with a new judicially declared mandate. Rubel spoke about the federal government and the Supreme Court providing many rights in all 50 states, including the 1967 Supreme Court decision Loving versus Virginia, which legalized interracial marriage nationwide. Democratic Representative Todd Achilles of Boise said the memorial would have no practical effect. Achilles said, "This is really, at the end of the day, nothing more than a grumpy letter, but with our names on it."
Idaho lawmakers are looking to expand options for students to go to schools other than public ones, but that could impact funds for rural schools. In his State of the State speech, Governor Brad Little proposed adding $150 million to the budget for schools. That includes $50 million for so-called school choice programs, which fund students going to private schools. However, Superintendent of the Fruitland School District Stoney Winston says this will hurt rural school districts like his, which are already underfunded and could mean finding funds in other ways like local voter-approved taxes.
Rural districts are not only sending their money in public tax dollars to support private education, but now they're having to pony up some money in order to meet some basic needs for the rural school districts.
State lawmakers are listening to Little's proposal. House Bill 1 is the Idaho Parental Choice Tax Credit, which provides up to $9,500 in tax credits to parents or guardians for the expense of non-public schools. Little says expanding school choice is needed in particular for students with unique physical and developmental conditions. But Winston points out that public special education is underfunded, and also that private schools aren't under the same obligations as public schools.
Private schools don't have to take students with disabilities. Public schools are mandated to do so. And I don't see that as a bad thing. I think that's what we should be doing. And we should be taking those students and making sure that we're giving them the best education possible to fit their needs.
Winston says lawmakers should take a step back and consider what they want education to look like in 20 years, especially in rural Idaho.
Our rural schools are the heart of communities, and I don't want to see that destroyed in the future.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency last week announced it will scrap the Biden administration's plans to limit PFAS contamination to 4 parts per trillion, a decision likely to impact the West Plains area near Spokane, where regulators have detected forever chemicals, also known as PFAS, in dozens of wells. PFAS, which are perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are believed to be in firefighting foam used at Spokane International Airport and the Fairchild Air Force Base, and that's where the contaminated wells have come from. The Project 2025 document from the Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing document for a Christian nationalist takeover of the U.S. government, targets environmental regulations and specifically calls for revisiting the designation of PFAS as a hazardous substance. The Spokesman Review reports Natural Resources Defense Council Senior Director for Health, Eric Olson, said, "It's clear that nobody voted for more PFAS in their drinking water or more in their air or to have more PFAS waste disposed of in their community. People are learning more about the health risks from PFAS that they're being exposed to without their consent. There will be more and more pressure on Congress and on the administration to do something about this problem." Olson said Trump Office of Management and Budget nominee Russ Vought will make the final decision on PFAS regulation. He said that nominee there has been pretty clear that he wants to basically shut down most regulatory action or protections. So even if the EPA wanted to do something, it's an open question as to whether the White House would let him do anything. Trump last week appointed toxicologist Nancy Beck as Environmental Protection Agency Office of Chemical Safety Senior Advisor. which is the position Beck held during the first Trump administration. Between 2017 and 2020, Beck fought against proposed stronger regulations for PFAS. The Office of Management and Budget rewrote PFAS regulations in early 2020.
Washington state mental health care providers are rallying behind a new bill aimed at addressing what they are calling the mental health care crisis. Research shows nearly half of Washington counties lack a psychiatrist, and many mental health care professionals in the state don't accept Medicaid or other public insurance. Jake Swanton with Inseparable says insurance companies blame a lack of providers, but he adds low reimbursement rates and administrative burdens imposed by insurance companies play a role in the shortage.
It's forcing a lot of these providers who are just small business owners or solo practitioners in some cases out of network and forcing them to not take insurance so that they can run their business.
Research shows in-network visit reimbursement is 22% higher for medical clinicians than for mental health practitioners providing the same services. House Bill 1432 aims to update Washington laws so insurance companies follow standard care guidelines while easing administrative hassles and financial risks for providers. London Breedlove with the Washington State Psychological Association says the pay disparity, along with stressful conversations with clients about coverage, contribute to the mental health provider shortage. She adds historical stigma surrounding mental health is partly responsible.
And we feel it every day, both in terms of these kinds of conversations that we're having to have, and also in terms of how we're reimbursed and how we're paid for our work.
House Bill 1432 also addresses clawbacks, where insurance companies retroactively decide a mental health visit wasn't medically necessary. Swanton explains this practice forces providers to repay reimbursements, causing financial strain, while leaving patients with surprise medical bills. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
The last group of firefighters from Idaho remaining in Los Angeles came home yesterday. About 100 firefighters from Idaho headed to Los Angeles January 8th and 9th. Idaho also sent 25 fire engines to the fire scenes in Los Angeles. Kamiai Fire Chief Billy Monahan, who was in Los Angeles to fight the fires, told the Lewiston Tribune, "I think many of the people that came here will cherish this assignment to be able to say that you were able to help California on something this big is what we do this for." Moynihan said the crews worked and rested in 24-hour shifts. He said, "We would work all night long. It was kind of difficult because there were times where you were sitting in your seat on the engine at 2 in the morning and you weren't able to lay down and sleep." The crews worked the Palisades fire and during the last week assisted homeowners and renters to come back to burned neighborhoods to survey damage and recover their possessions. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it'll be mostly clear through Thursday with a low of 19 tonight, highs 35 tomorrow, 38 Wednesday, and 41 on Thursday, lows 20 Tuesday night and 23 Wednesday night. Current temperature is 19. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. There's an Adopt a DJ program, there's a PayPal option, and there's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints up next. Music begins in earnest at 7:30 with Bex doing Spotlight. Chia Pets on playing music for you 9 to 11 tonight and more to come. Stay tuned. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. CAREFP is dedicated to progressive values, including justice and multiculturalism.